You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 25th of January 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show,
we're going to build a wall. I could wait about a year and a half until we finish our negotiations with Mexico, which will start immediately after we get to office, but I don't want to wait.
With Donald Trump set to action his long-promised wall, we'll ask how feasible the plan really is. My guests, Michael Binion and Kathleen Burke, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the latest on Turkey's constitutional referendum and why dystopian literature sales have received a boost this week.
If you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
We hope the next 30 minutes aren't quite that grim. We'll be talking about blue wine too, and why the tipple has run into trouble with the EU. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, and Michael Binion, Foreign Affairs Specialist for The Times. Welcome both to the programme. Donald Trump looks set to sign executive orders today, which will put in motion one of his most noted campaign pledges, a border wall between the US and Mexico. It's part of a series of measures that also include reducing the number of refugees eligible to settle in the US and preventing nationalities such as people from Syria, who Trump describes as terror-prone nations, from entering the country at all. Kathy, are we really going to see a physical wall between the two nations?
Well, he has said, well, maybe it'll be a fence, of course. 2,000 miles, even though part of it's already built, is a long, expensive expansion, especially if it's going to be 7 to 9 feet tall. He has to do something. It's too much a signal of what he wants to do. I think there's going to be some of it, yes. And I think, like the last section, reasons will be found to postpone it for a bit, I hope.
Michael, again, a physical wall between the two countries, in part, it might help him with this notion of like kickstarting the economy. I presume there's lots of people who make, you know, boringly, but products like cement and steel who would suddenly be galvanized and be making some money.
Well, if they make a physical wall 2,000 miles long and 9 feet high, I mean, that's 3 meters high, and 3,000 kilometers long, that would use an awful lot of cement. And an awful lot of steel.
And awful lot of money.
And it would be almost impossible. It would be an undertaking to build that like almost no other engineering product or project, rather. And I simply don't think it could be done. I mean, look at the amount of the money and labour it took to build the so-called separation fence that the Israelis put up along the frontier with the West Bank. Very, very expensive. And other walls of that kind, we go back to Hadrian's Wall between England and Scotland 2,000 years ago. Very expensive, and it only worked because they had a camp every 5 miles with soldiers on patrol watching out, because otherwise people just find a way to get over it.
I was going to say, 9 feet isn't very high. That's a ladder and a jump, isn't it?
Well, if it's a strong wall made of steel and concrete, you can just put a hook over it, couldn't you? And climb up, abseil up.
Yep.
Or dig under. Because, you know, when we look at the tunnels, for example, that, you know, cropped up in somewhere like in Gaza, then it was very simple for people to start digging deep underneath deep walls, both under and over. It's very difficult to police the whole thing as well.
Very, unless you do it as the East Germans did in the Berlin Wall, where you shoot people that you see trying to cross, or you have the thing electrified, or you have a minefield along the front of it. And that way, it might work, but you would kill several hundred people every year. And if you don't care about that, then it might work.
And tell me, the conversation with Mexico, Mr. Trump is still insisting, Kathleen, that he will get the Mexicans to pay. Again, do you think this is a sleight of hand that he will say, okay, within the renegotiations of treaties and trade between us and Mexico, I have put aside money, or they are going to give us more generous terms so that money will cover the wall? Or do you think he's literally going to believe that a cheque will be written by the Mexicans and delivered into his coffers?
Well, he obviously doesn't believe that because he's threatened somehow to steal all the remittances that the immigrants send back to Mexico. I mean, he's already said, well, the federal government will pay for it first and we'll get it back from Mexico. And he must assume, hope, that once that comes around, the wall's going to take a long time to build, as was quite clearly put out, Michael pointed out, that people will have forgotten. And there will be other things you can either celebrate or get angry about.
Michael, on the point of people being allowed access to America and the question of, like, suspending. So first of all, in the campaign, he said, you know, there should be, Muslims should not be allowed to enter America. And now this seems to be qualified in a way that is, you know, is still questionable, but is certainly less extreme than that. And he certainly seems to be picking off nations where there is instability, where there is insurgency or terrorism. Do you think this is somewhere where he is more likely to get his way and be able to put it into place?
Almost certainly, yes. And to many people, that sounds not unreasonable, that countries that have an ongoing terrorist insurgency, where there's a clear record of people having left that country to go and cause trouble elsewhere, would be exactly the places that would face increased inspection for every single visa application, and possibly a much larger number being rejected. And I think most Americans, indeed many Europeans, wouldn't quarrel with that. It's racist in that it brands certain countries as natural terrorists, and it's unfair because there are many good people in all the countries that might be branded in this way. But if you're going to do something to stop people coming in who look as though they might be intent on terrorism, that's the way to do it.
And a slight irony, Kathleen, in the sense that, you know, it was coalition forces who entered Iraq, who killed their leader, who in part are responsible for the turmoil that that country goes through now. And to say to, you know, young families or people hoping for a better start, you're not welcome anymore because of what's happened in your country, seems a bit of a weird twist of fate.
Oh, it's beyond irony. It's damnable. I think those who had chaps who had acted as interpreters and so forth for the American troops while they were there had difficulty getting asylum in the United States. I'd like to know what Mr. Trump means by enhanced vetting, because it can already can take up to 2 years to get a visa to get into the United States. You could die before you got in. Maybe that's what he's hoping, which isn't a very nice thing to say, but he doesn't say very many nice things either.
Michael, can I ask you what you make of we're at the start of a long process of reporting on Trump's America, and I think when you look at the U.S. papers, for example, even papers of records such as the New York Times or the Washington Post, they're certainly not screaming or shouting, but you notice a shift in the tone of their reporting, especially in the last few days, where they are calling him out for being a liar. And I think that's very unusual. One of the headlines in the New York Times said, the lie about the number of illegal immigrants who had been supposedly allowed to vote to deprive Mr. Trump of the popular vote. Do you think we're seeing, rather than media cowed by his demands and his shouting and his claims that they don't tell the truth, that actually the media is finally beginning to galvanize and call him out a bit more often?
I think that's absolutely true. And I think it's also very much Mr. Trump's own fault for sending out his press secretary on the very first day to pick a fight with the press. He didn't simply give alternative facts, as they're now called, in other words, something that's not true. He actually lambasted the press for reporting numbers he said were wrong over the number of people who attended the inauguration. Now, when it was clear that objective evidence, photographs and police numbers and all that kind of thing, pointed quite clearly to the figure being wrong, he didn't retreat, and not until the second day. And so he picked a fight and a confrontation over facts. Now, it's all very well to have an argument with the candidate over political issues and stances and things of that kind, but the press in America, as in most places, is pretty insistent that it gets the facts right. And therefore, when they see that objective facts, in other words, are there seven of these things or eight of them? It's an objective fact, which you can either count them or you can't count them, whatever it might be. When you start arguing about that, then I think the press is going to really have a go at what they see is an attempt to bamboozle the public with something that's simply untrue.
And can I add, of course, that the last president who tried to overcome the press, Nixon, was put down by the Supreme Court, who pointed out that the First Amendment requires freedom of the press as well as speech, and therefore the press knows that they're safe in that sense.
Catherine, can you just tell me a little bit again on that question? We saw so much reporting over the last few days lifting a little bit of the lid on what had gone on behind the scenes as he took power, and showing this a man who's very thin-skinned, who's easily kind of deflected from the key narrative. You know, as we see, we're talking about this fight with the press, for example. And while he may have come in on this kind of, you know, fanfare from voters who have felt outside of the system for a long time, he's going to fail them and himself, isn't he, if he cannot focus on the task at hand?
Well, quite obviously, I think. So in that sense, it's going to depend on the quality and the character of his advisors. If, as people seem to say, he tends to follow whomever he's last spoken to, I think we may begin to be even more relieved than some of us are that James Mattis is Secretary of Defense. And even Mr. Tillotson as Secretary of State doesn't take nothing from nobody, so it appears. So that the strong, important cabinet secretaries may well help to hold him back a bit more. I don't know about John Sullivan as the Homeland Secretary. I don't know how strong he is. It looks as though that it's hard to know who is going to curtail some of his more egregious domestic proposals.
Michael, I want to come back to the issue of immigration. And while many of the things Mr. Trump may say are racist or complicated or not right for many people, he's touching on things which, it's interesting when you look at some of the properly, you know, right-wing press here in the UK, they're kind of saying the same things, really. It's interesting how many newspapers on the right here are actually very pro-Trump, very supportive of his first days in office. And they're saying the same things. You know, we should not have freedom of movement. We need to stop Syrians coming to settle in our country. We don't need any more people. He's tapped into a narrative which may not be as pronounced exactly in every other country, but seems to be bubbling to the fore. Is he speaking now a more common language there of the centre and even of the right these days?
I think he is, and I think it's a common language not just in America and Britain, but worldwide. I mean, if you look at, for example, Australia, this is a country which was built on immigration, as was America. And for years and years and years, immigrants were welcomed. They had special assisted passage to go there. Immigration is a very hot issue in Australia because they sort of say, look, we are more or less full now, or at least we can only take in certain numbers. If we just open the doors, everybody will come in. Now, in the old days, you could just open the doors, but people couldn't afford to come. Now, people can afford to come and will find ways of coming, and there is quite a possibility that you could have a country, if it had open borders, that would have 1, 2, 3 million people, if it was a reasonably well-to-do country, 3 million people seeking a better life coming tomorrow. And therefore, this is quite a controversial and sensitive subject. And it's not only rich, developed countries, but you'll find other countries in the third world or even semi-developed countries or developing countries. Take South Africa, for example. They have a lot of people coming in from neighbouring countries, and they're getting rather fed up with it, and they're going to try to stop them.
Well, we're going to return to the issue of alternative facts later on in the show, but we're going to move on now to Turkey, which is set to announce the date of a referendum that would allow constitutional changes extending the powers of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The vote in early April would see the current parliamentary system changed into a presidential one, but as we've seen regularly over the past few months, from Brexit to the halted FARC deal in Colombia, referendums can throw back political curveballs. Just ask David Cameron or Matteo Renzi what they think of those. Well, Michael, Turkey, it may go a little bit more to plan, but what do you think is the likely outcome of the referendum in Turkey?
I think it probably will go Erdogan's way, and he will get what he wants. But you're absolutely right about why referenda are unpredictable. And in fact, I think they're thoroughly undemocratic, because you think you're asking the people. Actually, people don't really answer the question at all. They answer a completely different question. It doesn't matter what the question is on a referendum ballot. The answer is always the same. And the answer is a punch on the nose for the government, because it's a chance for people just to say, I'm unhappy, I don't like this, I'm not having it, here's my protest vote. So they don't answer the question that's asked usually. Now, in Turkey, I think there will be a chance to say, I don't like the enemies of Turkey, therefore I'm going to stick with Erdogan, because he's portrayed it as, are you a patriot or are you not? Because Turkey's had terrorism, they've had real turmoil on their borders, and he's made it a sort of question as, do you support the idea of a strong Turkey or not? Which is not actually the question. The question is simply a constitutional one. Do you want me to have absolute power and be very difficult to restrain? If they explained all that, I don't think he'd get quite the vote he will get. But I do think in this case, he'll get what he wants.
Can I ask Michael a question that I've been wondering about? Why did the leader of the opposition turn around 180 degrees and now strongly support Erdogan?
Well, I think they were in danger of being marginalized. I mean, Erdogan is riding a sort of wave of popularity following the attempted coup. It's a popularity because all those who are critics have been arrested, effectively, and there is not much open freedom of expression to express another point of view. And the opposition also hasn't really got a convincing narrative of its own. Erdogan has captured the patriotic vote. He's made Turkey look strong and great over the deal over Syria. You know, Turkey's the only one that could do the deal with Russia, it seems. And so he's riding high at the moment. And I think the opposition felt that, rather like the Labour Party in Britain, it's somewhat lost the plot.
Well, he certainly seems to have been able to turn around the narrative. Kathleen, do you think we're seeing a general rise in, you know, the ability of strongman leaders to play up the risks of security and danger and to tap into their populist vote to, you know, secure power? You know, there are some small similarities between Erdogan and Trump. Both seem to have had, you know, the ability to look at, you know, turmoil and difficulty and disaster and turn it into electoral gold.
That's a very complicated question, I think. I mean, there was a brilliant book written when I was a student called The Man on Horseback, which was, in times of worry and turmoil, people turned to the strong leader. Now, Russia is famous for believing that they are always, that people seem to believe they're better run when there's a strong man at the top. It's slightly unusual, I think, for it to move it to so many areas. But I guess people fundamentally, if they're worried, are happy when someone tells them what to do.
Michael, Theresa May is heading to Turkey for a meeting with Erdogan. Are we also in a strange period where you get no sense that she's going to kind of question anything about, you know, what's happening in Turkey, or when she meets Mr. Trump about, we've heard her say that she's not going to kind of go along with any of his kind of more sexist comments, but you don't feel that she is in a position to question either of these men. Is that kind of notion that we want our leaders to represent our values as well when they travel abroad just not really on the cards at the moment?
Not really at the moment, and particularly not coming from a country that's in a rather weak position internationally. Brexit has really, really made Britain look a much weaker world power, because potentially we are now on our own. Without the cover of the whole of the EU with us and speaking with us. Excuse me. But I think for that reason also, Theresa May is going there looking to Turkey for possible big future trade deals in 2 or 3 years' time. But at the same time, she is much more concerned to keep Turkey within the Western alliance, because Turkey seems to be rather chafing at the bounds that bind it to its own allies in NATO. I mean, it's much happier doing deals with Russia, NATO's notional opponent, than it is where it is at the moment. And it, in fact, has a big quarrel with the Americans over the future of the Syrian Kurds. So I think Theresa May will be trying to say to him, we support you, and we support the re-establishment of democracy after the failed coup. And he is very sensitive over that. He said, nobody in the West really helped me. Nobody supported me. It was only Putin that sent a telegram to congratulate me. And she's trying to say, but remember, you are one of our NATO allies and please stick with us. So to preach lessons to him about democracy or say, what about these people thrown into prison, certainly wouldn't work with a man with such a thin skin.
I'm beginning to think a thin skin is a sine qua non for strong men.
You're listening to Midori House. We've all got very thick skins here, by the way. With me, Andrew Tuck, Michael Binion and Kathleen Burke. Coming up next, why the Trump presidency is helping George Orwell top the bestseller lists.
A new year is upon us and a fresh issue of Monocle is hitting the newsstand. Eager to start the year as we mean to go on, we've packed the February issue full of ideas for how to make our cities and our lives healthier, smoother, and, well, just better. In our 100th issue, we take a whistle-stop tour of three cities designed for healthy living, offer up some lessons, courtesy of a group of Dutch nuns, on how to learn a new foreign language, and we discover the smartest methods out there for making cities safer. The February issue of Monocle will have you shaking off any final vestiges of holiday slumber and sprinting into 2017 well-informed and suitably inspired. Monocle's February issue. Buy your copy today. Happy reading.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Kathleen Burke and Michael Binion. George Orwell's classic novel, 1984, set in a dystopian future, has enjoyed a sales boost in the past few days. And analysts think it could be attributed to newly Orwellian-sounding language coming from the Trump administration, namely Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway's coining of the term alternative facts. Here she is on NBC's Meet the Press. Enjoy.
Don't be so overly dramatic about it, Chuck. You're saying it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that. But the point remains.
Wait a minute. Alternative facts? Alternative facts, four of the five facts he uttered.
The one thing he got right, Chuck,
was Zeke Miller. Four of the five facts he uttered were just not true. Look, alternative facts are not facts.
They are indeed falsehood. The term has drawn comparisons to phrases from the Orwell novel such as doublethink, the practice of being able to believe in two contradictory narratives at the very same time. Kathy, we increasingly see many of Orwell's century-old ideas coming into play. Any other dystopian novels that you read of an evening when you go home?
The last thing after being a historian is that I want to read about alternative dystopias. Well, if we can go for words instead of... what about Animal Farm? All animals are equal. Some animals are more equal than others.
Yes, Mr. Orwell had it coined. Did you have one for us, Michael?
I don't have a particular novel because all novels now deal with sort of fantasies or future scenarios where people deny something, then it's proved true. I mean, think of the one climate deniers are proved wrong, and we get The Day After Tomorrow, the film where, you know, suddenly you have a massive freeze, except in our case, of course, it's going to be the world boiling instead of freezing, but whatever it might be, people who don't listen to facts and then come up, the whole world goes wrong. There are lots of novels based on that sort of thing, but I don't think any were quite as astute, sharp, and to the point as both the novels George Orwell wrote, because he was writing at a time when that sort of policy, the last time, that really was governing a whole nation, namely Stalin's Soviet Union, which was essentially based on telling people something that was absolutely at odds with what was true. I suppose you could say the same about Nazi Germany, but Orwell pointed to something that everyone could see. And I think we haven't had quite such an emphasis on using alternative facts, as it were, as part of your presidential politics, as we are now seeing.
Kellyanne Conway's speak, Cathy, why does it not kind of, I don't know, upset more people? Why have we got so used to it, even after like two or three days, that this is just the way the Trump administration is?
Because we can't do anything about it, essentially, is make sure that people still see it. What's the well-known satire website in America which says it's shutting down because it's now beyond satire? The point is that all you can do with the press, for example, is fight back by saying this is wrong and so forth and so on. But we can't. The only thing that's going to modify the Trump approach is defeats. I don't mean presidential defeats, but I mean, for example, in the polls or in Congress or in not being able to sign not being able to say, do this, and it not happen.
It was interesting. There was a piece in the Washington Post, Michael, which said that actually when Trump watched her performance on TV, he was delighted with it. He thought that she'd done a great, great job, and he was actually more irked that, you know, Spicer, when he'd gone out, hadn't been even more combative, and even said even more that, you know, that there were definitely the case that there were more people had been on the mall watching him rather than Obama. Again, this world of, you know, doublespeak and, you know, just misdirection. Do you think they will come a cropper for it in the end, or is it just, you know, the liberals who will care about it and the people who his supporters don't give a damn?
Well, depressingly, it does seem that a lot of people don't care a damn, because we saw this right throughout the campaign, that candidate Trump said things that were either completely unbelievable or deeply insulting to all sorts of people, and then quite soon afterwards either denied that he'd said them or said something completely opposite. And whenever people tried to pick him up, he just sort of said, well, you know, you're just fake news. I don't believe you. And most voters seem to go along with it. I mean, otherwise he wouldn't, A, have become the candidate, and B, have won the election, which is the great surprise. If it really mattered that what he said corresponded exactly to the truth, more people would have been angered. But they weren't. And I think that a lot of people simply don't care.
Well, now we'll see who cares about this topic. I think Kathleen Burt does, because one of Kathleen's many talents, aside from contemporary history, is spotting a good drop of wine. Oh, it was good being here at Christmas when she turned up with several bottles, I can tell you. Now, she's published books on the topic, such as Is This Bottle Corked? So we thought we'd end the show by getting her view on GIC. You may not have heard of the Spanish wine, and that's because the EU has designated its naturally created colour, a bright blue instead of red or white, as being not technically admissible under current regulations. There is no blue wine category under the EU. Kathy, do you like blue wine?
Michael and I were talking about blue food before we came on the show, and he pointed out after research that people think that blue food or drink is actually, there's something disgustingly wrong with it. I mean, the thing is,
certainly blue drinks. I've never seen a blue cocktail that you kind of actually wanted
to
drink.
Well, this is the point. In fact, they did a very interesting experiment on a nature program on British television only 2 days ago. I was watching it, where they dyed birdseed blue, red, and then left it uncoloured, natural colour, sort of golden, and to see whether the birds would eat blue birdseed. I mean, it was completely tasteless, it just was a different colour. And they found out that all the birds avoided blue, because blue in the animal kingdom is naturally associated with either poison or mould. It's not a colour that seems to appeal as a food. In fact, apart from a few berries, I can't think of a single food that we eat that is blue.
I mean, one thing about this wine, the reason the EU won't accept it is because wine in the EU is made from grapes. Now, the blue color in this wine, indigotine, is actually, yes, it's natural, but it's not part of the grape. And the point is that it's natural. It's organic, but dirt is organic. But if you put dirt in a bottle of wine, you don't say this is this great organic natural bottle of wine, do you? Well, I wouldn't put in indigo dye into my wine and say, look how great it is.
Do you have any GIC in your cellar, as it were?
One of the very great things about this program is I learned so much that I had not been aware of before, and that's one of them.
I take it, Michael, you don't have a bottle of an evening.
I don't, no, I don't. I mean, even green wine, which in fact is what the Portuguese call their white wine, is not really green. It's sort of just slightly off-white and greenish tinge.
Well, I can tell you, after a day like this, I'd have wine of any colour. But for now, I'm just going to thank Kathleen Burke and Michael Binion for joining us on this episode of Midori House. The show, well, it was produced by Tom Hall. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and also by Elisa Mare. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. There's going to be more music next, and at 1900 hours, it's the Entrepreneurs even, a show about how to run a business or make yours a better one, which is, of course, presented by Danny Giacopelli. And we can have more on the day's main stories, where I fear Mr. Trump may be making a return or two, on the Monocle Daily, which is at 2200 hours. Midori House, it's going to be back at the very same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. And don't forget to buy the new issue of the magazine, which is on newsstands now. But from me, Andrew Tuck, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.